Hello, and welcome to Crossroads, the infrastructure podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Carmody, Managing Editor for Infralogic for the Americas. Very excited to have on a very special guest today. We're welcoming Chris Ortega, Morgan Stanley Infrastructure Partners, Head of the Americas.
Lovely to be here, Jonathan. Thank you for having me.
We're really seeing a very interesting moment for the middle market, aren't we, Chris? I think a few years ago, we were seeing perhaps diminishing interest in the middle market, but it does appear now that the investors committing funds to the sector are gaining interest again in this interesting niche in infrastructure investing. I wonder if you could start off by telling us a little bit about why the middle market matters.
Yeah, sure. I think what we're seeing is this evolution where folks are increasingly looking at the middle market. And to me, the question is why? I think from our perspective, a lot of that goes to people recognizing that there's a better risk reward in the middle market relative to what they see in other segments of infrastructure. So to double click on that a little bit, what's the driver for that more compelling risk reward? I think very simply, it comes down to competition, right? Over the course of the last 20 years, as we've seen infra grow as an asset class, the vast majority of that growth has been at the upper end, at the mega fund level. More and more dollars really looking for those larger and larger size deals. At the same time, from a deal count perspective, 80% of the deals done within the infrastructure space are in the middle market. So when we look at that, we see this really interesting supply-demand balance where more and more capital going larger in size, but really that bulk of deals remaining in the middle market. And that's what, for us, leads to the conclusion that there's more opportunity and better risk reward when we're looking at investments in the space.
And as we're thinking about the middle market, I think it's always good at the outset to define the terms. So in terms of the enterprise value of the companies that you're looking at, the size of the funds that you're raising, we know you just finished capital raising for the fourth fund in your strategy. Perhaps you could tell us how you define the middle market.
Sure. Listen, and I think different people have slightly different perspectives on this, but at a high level, I think it's fund sizes from, call it, $2.5-3 billion-ish on the low end to $7-7.5 billion-ish on the high end. Why do I go there? Maybe to break that down is if you're going to have a $3 billion to a $7 billion fund, and those funds generally will do 10 to 12 deals in each one of those funds, you'll end up looking at companies with enterprise values of, say, $500 million to $1.5 billion. In size. And that's really the driver in terms of what are the underlying investments in companies going into your portfolio that I think should define the middle market. And the question then is, why is that the right sizing from a company perspective? On the low end, I would say, is once you start going below a $500 million-ish dollar company from an enterprise value perspective, you're probably talking about a company that's less than $50 million of EBITDA. For us, because one of the important parts of infrastructure is providing earnings durability and stability, not wanting to take a whole bunch of risk around business model, that for us is really the place where we feel quite confident in terms of there's a robust business model in place. You have those guardrails in terms of what the trajectory of that business will be. And then on the other end of the spectrum, on the larger size of things, when you get to a $1.5-2 billion company or so, at that point, you're talking about a company of $150 million, $175 million of EBITDA in size. And again, for us, that's really what defines middle market before you start looking at situations materially larger. And at that point, we then start to question, after our hold period, who are your potential buyers? How do you exit?
So it's generally earlier stage assets in the infrastructure investment lifecycle. You're talking a lot about platform building with these assets. Perhaps we could explore a little bit the exits that you're thinking about there. I've always found it interesting looking at the space, Chris, trying to understand who are the most appropriate buyers for some of the assets that infrastructure funds acquire, often grow, develop into platforms. So talk to me a little bit about that, about the realizable exits that you can get for some of your assets.
Sure. So I think for a long time, the way we really thought of ourselves is as investors, since we really play in that core plus value add space, where we're de-risking an asset profile, and then ultimately taking that company or that asset and providing a de-risked series of cash flow streams for the next buyer. And what we really want to do is always ensure that we have as robust competitive tension as possible. So we're looking for potentially strategics, always to look and bid for our assets. Frequently, they could pay a premium because of synergy, for example. The second bucket we look to are direct investors. At times, sovereign wealth funds, some of the Canadian pension funds, some of the Australian pension funds, who jump in part because for lower risk assets, they also provide a lower cost of capital, which could be attractive for us from a monetization perspective. But thirdly, and equally important to us, are other potential infrastructure funds, financial buyers. And for us, really what we want to do is to ensure that we have bidders from each one of those categories, because that's what really drives robust competitive tension in process. Speaking from a Morgan Stanley Infrastructure Partners experience specifically, over the last 18 months, we've had 5 monetizations. In each one of those, we've had a variety of bidders in each, but we have ultimately signed contracts with financial sponsors in all 5 of them, which just goes to the competitive tension. The reason I think that's part of the middle market story is once one goes up in fund size or company size, some of these companies at the end of a 4 or 5 year hold period are just too large for another financial sponsor to come and to participate. So for us, really having that clarity at the start of an investment in terms of what our exit optionality is really important. And that's in part why we've never exited to a continuation vehicle, for example, today, but we're really focused on providing our limited partners full exits, real DPI, and that being a big driver for us.
There's obviously many different approaches to investing in the space, but I wanted to narrow it down into examining how growth functions as a core value driver for Morgan Stanley Infrastructure Partners. It's traditionally, as an asset class, been associated with yield and stability, but I'm trying to understand how growth of the businesses that you acquire features as an important component of your playbook when you're analyzing assets and considering the amount of yield that you could get out of a potential investment before you realize it. Could you talk a little bit about your growth strategy when you're analyzing and acquiring businesses?
Sure. And I may use a slightly different word rather than orient on growth. I think for us, it's really value add. And frequently, that value add certainly could come through growth, Jonathan, a bit to your point. What I don't want to get lost is absolutely bedrock foundational principle for us is stability is essential for all of our investments. So it's not a stability or value add, it's really both in terms of what we're looking for, with yield also being a significant component of that as well. So maybe to reframe the question slightly, I'll say, how do we think about that value add in terms of when we are making an investment? And to your question, it's a critical component, because I think historically when infra started 20 years ago, one was able to earn a teens return by holding a toll road for a significant period of time. But as those early vintages of infrastructure funds did well and more competition came into the space, some of that low-hanging fruit ultimately then got competed away. So those really easy assets to hold without much management ultimately went from being teens assets to high single-digit assets and really more core in terms of what they were providing. So from our perspective, to drive to those mid-teen sorts of returns, one does need to have a value-add component to those things. And that could come through a couple of different avenues for us. Sometimes it's by developing and constructing an asset. And again, we'll do that, for example, on the data center side or the power side, but always being mindful that we have contract in place before we do something like that. Sometimes one of the things we do a lot of, over half of our deals have been carve outs. Many of them have been in the digital space. And sometimes part of our strategy is when we carve out an asset from a legacy owner, sometimes competitors will not want to be on that network or that system if it's a piece of cell towers or if it's fiber. But when it's in our hands, we can then commercialize it to multiple parties as well. And sometimes that incremental commercialization above and beyond that original tenant will be part of our strategy as well. Other times, candidly, it's just simply saying, we see a team that's been able to develop successfully, and then how do we accelerate that? So how do we do more of that, whether it be in terms of building out more utility scale solar, for example, or more multi-tenant data centers, where we feel like there's a team that is expertise and has executed at a very high level historically, but there's an opportunity to do more of that because of the demand pull in the space.
One of the businesses that you exited in 2025 was Seven Seas Water. That was a company that you'd acquired previously from private equity companies, and you ended up exiting to EQT, their sixth infrastructure fund, last year. I'm curious, Chris, if you could talk a little bit about how that investment played out in line with the strategy that you're describing. What did you do with Seven Seas Water to expand the business, to improve the efficiencies and the management team? And how did you drive it towards that exit, which you realized last year?
So that's a hallmark investment for us. And interestingly, the origin story of Seven Seas is previously was actually a publicly traded company. And we partnered up with a strategic, and there was a commercial consumer water business as part of that. And we said that that's not an infrastructure business. That's not interesting to us. So we acquired it. It was a public to private, where we then from the beginning split up those businesses and really took what we thought were the infrastructure assets of that business. So in some ways, a carve out, a public to private deal in conjunction with a carve out at the beginning, a lot of complexity. But then to your question, we went in, we rebuilt the management team, the leadership team there, and the two businesses that we had were a desalination business that has a lot of long-term durable contracts, a lot of visibility in terms of that cash flow that we really liked, but then also a wastewater business where we saw an immense amount of opportunity to continue to accelerate that growth. It really tied to part of our thematic view in terms of the relative of water, particularly in the U.S. as we go both through whether it be climate change, as well as just the value of water with incremental water consumption coming from data centers. So wastewater management has been a key theme for us. And what we really did is we focused that management team in particular in terms of how to accelerate the growth of that wastewater business and really making sure we did that at the same time with getting infrastructure-like contracts where we had duration plus inflation protection. And then to your point, we were able ultimately to run a sales process where we had, again, a variety of interest from different groups of buyers. But ultimately, it was EQT that kind of distinguished themselves in that process and is now the owner of the business.
That's really fascinating. I think it plays into a theme that we're exploring here at InfraLogic when it comes to the suitability of assets for different kinds of asset owners. We've talked a lot about private equity firms and how infrastructure capital has grown so much that it's very attractive as an exit strategy for private equity managers. I'm trying to think in terms of the businesses, when you're looking at opportunities in the sector, trying to identify those opportunities that have infra-like characteristics. When you're looking at those kind of things in the industry, what are the key levers that you should be thinking about in terms of the contracting, the regulation, the operational build-out opportunities, things that can move an asset along that spectrum away from private equity to more infrastructure-like businesses?
So I think for us, our North Star on this is always to think about why are our clients and partners allocating funds to us in the first place? What are they looking to get in their portfolio from allocation to Morgan Stanley infrastructure partners? So I think the three functional things that we always are very focused on are one, a very high degree of earnings, durability, and visibility. That generally comes through long-dated contract in terms of how we get there. Two is a very high degree of essentiality. So we want to make sure that the companies and the assets that we'll have very low risk of kind of substitution, that they're going to be assets that maintain importance and relevance over a 20, 30, 40 year history relative to the go forward from our ownership perspective. But then the third thing we look for is inflation protection. I think part of what CIOs are looking for from their infra portfolio is making sure that with the ups and downs, whether it be in their private equity book or their fixed income book or their real assets, their real estate books, that they're continuing to get investments that really are insulated from some of those pressures relative to where we sit. So those are the things we look for. So then to your question, how do we then do that? I think a lot of it goes to continuing to build out contract tenor for our assets, adding more assets that are long duration in nature. Sometimes also for us, it's through incremental development and construction. There are times where there are situations where we could be the party that steps in, particular if we have a contract on the other side in place with that inflation protection, with that tenor and durability, where we're somewhat expertized in taking that construction risk and then providing that de-risked then operating asset to another party. So that's another frequent place where we step in and the value add that we could provide.
One of the other defining characteristics of Morgan Stanley Infrastructure, Chris, is definitely the diversity in your portfolio. This is something that's key to mid-market fund managing, as I understand it. And so I'm curious that when you're looking at the assets, when you've got fresh funds to deploy, how does portfolio construction differ versus a large cap infrastructure fund?
Sure. So I think for us, it goes back to that question of what are our clients looking for? And I think chief investment officers, when they allocate us, part of what they want also is investments that are not going to be correlated with the rest of their private equity portfolios or alternative portfolios generally. What we really pride ourselves in is ensuring that we're not investing in assets that will look like and behave like the rest of their portfolios when there's economic volatility. So what does that mean in practice? For example, when we look at the transportation sector, I think a lot of historic infrastructure transportation assets are heavily GDP geared in terms of where they sit. We've taken the approach that we're looking for transportation assets, for example, that are much more closed loop in nature. For example, they could be Jones Act vessels, they could be dedicated toll roads, they could be Italian rail businesses in terms of where we are. Why do we do that? We think it's a more interesting and idiosyncratic collection of investments that won't have that correlation to overall GDP gearing, and then provide a lot of that ballast and insulation from a volatility perspective relative to our clients' books on the alternative side. So that's a big part of what we do. And we think in particular on the middle market side, you could find those off the run situations and do it in a size that works for us, that candidly is really challenging to do if you're trying to deploy $2.5 billion at a time. Frankly, there aren't Jones Act vessel businesses, there aren't dedicated toll roads of that size and scale that generally fit.
Certainly the question on everybody's mind at the moment is how are investors like yourselves looking at the digital infrastructure space? You've been long-term investors in companies like Lightpath since I think about 2020. You've got a very diversified portfolio across multiple jurisdictions as well, data center companies like UltraEdge in Europe, and also your investment in Flexential as well. So I'm curious, how is Morgan Stanley Infrastructure Partners approaching the digital infrastructure sector that's so in vogue right now? And how are those assets complementary to some of your power portfolio assets as well? I wonder if there's any synergies that you're finding between those.
So there's definitely synergies from a market knowledge perspective, and where we're seeing this huge demand pull in the United States in particular. For the first time in 25 years, we have power demand growth, part certainly driven by AI and the data center surge. But I think to the nub of your question, we are thematic investors, but if all we're doing is investing in the same theme as everybody else, if we're investing in the same theme on the front page of the Wall Street Journal or the Financial Times, there's really not much edge there. It's hard to have a distinguished investment track record doing that. So then for us, the approach really is to ensure that we're not necessarily looking to be contrarian, but maybe what's a secondary or tertiary theme from that main headline? where the risk reward may be a little bit more interesting to us. So for example, for us, rather than invest in hyperscale data centers, we've invested in wholesale multi-tenant data centers, a little bit of a less competitive space. You could get in at a much more attractive entry valuation. So we found that a bit more compelling. Relatedly to your question on the power side, power pricing has gone up materially over the last 2 years. That's true both in terms of what you could sell power companies for, as well as where you could contract for a power purchasing agreement right now. When we see those dynamics, we say, listen, now's a great time to be selling our power assets. And that's what we've done over the last couple of years. To buy in, you're now buying at a higher entry valuation. So rather than buy in for those operating assets, we're really focused on development there. So again, it's figuring out what's your edge, what's your angle. And I think part of the benefit of the mid-market and what we really pride ourselves on is you have more opportunity to do that on a bilateral basis. Out of our last fund, Fund 4, every deal that we've done so far has been bilateral in nature. I think part of the benefit this size, it's possible to make these investments and acquire these assets when they're $1 billion in size through bilateral conversation. Really difficult if it's a publicly traded company with a $5, $10 billion market cap for a board of directors to allow that to happen when you start to scale up in size.
And just to continue that thought with the mention of the gas plants that you've sold recently, your thoughts on how to find value in the market at the moment with such extraordinary prices for data centers and everything else. I'm thinking about the energy transition narrative that has certainly shifted over the last few years. Everybody wants to talk about powering data centers. That is paramount in everybody's minds. But the energy transition narrative hasn't gone away, and it's still a concern for so many people and for many investors as well. How do you think about the role of traditional fuels like gas today? Obviously, you've sold your power plants, but looking at that alongside newer energy transition investments, whether that's in renewables or battery storage or something that we haven't thought about yet, Chris.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I've been doing this long enough where when we started energy transition, natural gas was firmly a part of that, and it was viewed as a bridge fuel and critical to energy transition. Then we went through a period where people were moving away from things like natural gas, and now it's coming back in vogue as an important fuel source. The way we think about it, frankly, is it's not mutually exclusive. We are actively investing in renewables right now. We're also certainly open and pursuing opportunities on natural gas-fired generation as well. The driver for all of that for us really is what are the unit economics of those opportunities and the development. And because of that demand growth that we're seeing, in particular in the U.S., but also in Europe and Australia as well right now, you could find more and more compelling unit economics because you do have, whether it be the hyperscalers themselves or just the presence of hyperscalers raising power pricing for everyone in an area, supporting that incremental development build. So for us, it's not a mutually exclusive. Does it need to be just renewables or just thermal? The answer is yes. It's certainly both. In terms of where we are because of the growth and the demand in terms of where we sit today, obviously important to be good stewards, both from a capital perspective as well as environmental stewards as well. So that is a focus. But I would observe as well, at least from a U.S. perspective, the single biggest phenomenon that's resulted in CO2 reduction in the U.S. historically has been coal to gas switching. There are parts of the story where we do need both. We want to be cognizant of both, but there's a role for both.
Okay. And then just to wrap it up at the end of the conversation now, I remember starting out in the industry 10, 12 years ago, looking at that very core portfolio of pipelines and toll roads and all the rest of it. And now looking at the data centers and the small cells and geothermal and everything else. So we're really in a new phase of infrastructure investing. We talked about how that's changed for the mid-market, for the large caps and other investors. But just as a final point, Chris, where do you see the most compelling opportunities emerging over this next cycle?
Sure. We touched on it a little bit, Jonathan. You can no longer get a 15% return holding a toll road. We've now moved to data centers and power being part of that. And I think that secular trend will continue to run. But part of the challenge is given all the focus on data centers and power right now, that then becomes pretty efficiently priced. So we continue to pull on those threads. For us, that means what else in the ecosystem will benefit from some of these big secular trends. For example, we see that on the data center side with fiber to the data centers being another really interesting area, and where in our Lightpath investment, we're working very hard on that. We also see that through distributed generation, for example, on the power side, in terms of where we sit as well. But there are also new themes that are constantly coming up too. The combination of the recent geopolitical events, whether we go back a few years and look at Ukraine, or more currently look at what's just happened with the Strait of Hormuz, I think Europe and Asia in particular need to reconsider their views, not simply of pricing for energy, but just simply energy security and availability. And I think one of the lessons learned is that to be primarily sourced from only one area creates risk for both Asia as well as Europe. So our conclusion there is that creates just incremental opportunity, for example, within the LNG ecosystem broadly, a place where we've played historically. Previously, we did that through floating storage regas units in an investment that we had, but we see FSRUs being interesting. We see pipelines being interesting. We see liquefaction itself being as well. So it's that belief that some of the current secular themes will continue to run, but your question, what else is there coming down? So that would be an area that we're focused on, certainly in terms of the go forward as well.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Chris. And that's about all we have time for today. I'd like to thank Chris Ortega, head of the Americas for Morgan Stanley Infrastructure Partners, for his contribution and for sharing his views on the sector and Morgan Stanley strategy. Thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. It's a pleasure.
And to all of our listeners out there, thank you very much for joining us on Crossroads, the infrastructure podcast, available anywhere you get your podcasts.
One small plug that anyone in the New York City area, or who will be in the New York City area on the 3rd of June, we are hosting our annual InfraLogic Investors Forum at the Brookfield Place Convene. We have a brilliant lineup of top-level speakers from across the industry and over 450 registrants so far. To find out more information and to book your place, go to our website at www.infralogic.com. Tickets are still available, and we look forward to seeing you there. Once again, this is Jonathan Carmody, InfraLogic Managing Editor for the Americas, signing off.